Good evening. In the news tonight, confusion over the takeaway from a meeting on DACA.
It was interpreted by some that we had a deal on the bill, but that wasn't on the package. That wasn't the case.
The mass exodus of Rohingya from Myanmar into Bangladesh.
Women and children are arriving hungry and malnourished.
And memories of LGBT activist Edie Windsor.
Some of my earliest memories of Edie Windsor and Thea Speier date back to maybe 15 or 20 years ago.
With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Thursday, September 14th, 2017. Beginning with DACA. Nancy Pelosi, House Minority Leader, says reports in the press that she and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer reached a deal on DACA with Trump at a dinner last night are incorrect. She says they agreed on a path forward, and that path is the passage of the DREAM Act. Pelosi.
Well, we agreed on our path, which is our insistence in every conversation with the Speaker, with the President, or with the Dreamers, that it will be the DREAM Act sponsored by Congresswoman Lucille Wortmann-Allard, which will, on September 25th or 6th, morph into a bill by Congresswoman, the chairwoman of the Hispanic Caucus, Congresswoman Lujan Grisham, into a discharge petition.
The DREAM Act of 2017 is a bipartisan bill which allows U.S.-raised immigrant youth to earn lawful permanent residence and American citizenship. The 2017 version of the DREAM Act is the latest of several bills which have been introduced to address the issue. It's also been introduced in the Senate by Senators Dick Durbin of Illinois and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Pelosi spoke to reporters today at her weekly briefing in Washington, D.C. She was asked if she trusts Donald Trump and whether the Dreamers should trust him.
Now, is that a fair question?
Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
When we're talking about this legislation to protect the Dreamers, yes, I do trust that the president is sincere in understanding that the public supports that overwhelmingly the public supports not sending these young people back. President, we've had a discussion of this quite thoroughly, and Leader Schumer and I said coming out of the meeting, it was interpreted by some that we had a deal on the bill, but that wasn't on the package. That wasn't the case. We had an agreement to move forward. In our view, with the DREAM Act as the basis for how we protect the Dreamers and for further discussions on what provisions relating to the border might be in an accompanying bill or whatever as we go forward. So I trust the president in that regard.
On moving forward with Trump, she says, it's one issue at a time.
I do think that one by one you establish a more understanding of whether in the president's case, understanding of the legislative process and on our part, what some of his priorities might be as we go forward. But there's plenty of work to be done in many areas. And we talk about this and we talk about infrastructure. We talk about a number of issues, trade, et cetera. There are plenty of areas to find common ground. This is one of them. And maybe on some other issues, we won't find common ground.
Meanwhile, at 6:10 this morning, Trump tweeted, "No deal was made last night on DACA. Massive border security would have to be agreed to in exchange for consent, would be subject to vote."
800,000 young people brought here, no fault of their own. So we're working on a plan. We'll see how it works out. But we're going to get massive border security as part of that. And I think something can happen. We'll see what happens.
And Donald Trump remains committed to building a barrier along the U.S.-Mexican border. He spoke to reporters as he was departing Washington, D.C., about to board Air Force One en route to Florida.
"The wall will come later. We're right now renovating large sections of wall, massive sections, making it brand new. We're doing a lot of renovation. We're building four different samples of the wall to see which one we're going to choose and the wall is going to be built. It'll be funded a little bit later.
Back to Florida real quick.
You get an outlet?
Well, we want to get massive border security, and I think that both Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, I think they agree with it. But so we met last night with, as you know, Schumer, Pelosi, and a whole group, and I think we're fairly close, but we have to get massive border security.
Can we get Ryan McConnell on board?
Oh, I think he's on board. Yeah, Mitch is on board. Paul Ryan's on board. We all feel, look, 92% of the people agree on DACA. But what we want is we want very, very powerful border security, okay? We're going down to Florida. We'll see you in Florida. Ryan and McConnell agree with us on DACA. We're very much on board. I spoke to them, yes.
To add more confusion for those trying to make sense of Trump's stance, he said he's not looking at citizenship for young immigrants living in the U.S. illegally and not looking at amnesty. But then Trump tells reporters in Florida that we are looking at allowing people to stay here. A search warrant has been granted for a Florida nursing home where 8 patients died days after Hurricane Irma. Hollywood police say state and local authorities are conducting a criminal investigation to determine what led to the patients' deaths at the rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills. They say detectives are on the scene and their initial investigation determined the facility had some power, but its air conditioning system wasn't fully functional. Meanwhile, Florida Power and Light Company says electricity will be back up and running for all homes and businesses on the state's East Coast by the end of Sunday, September 17th. And they say the West Coast, where Hurricane Irma caused the greatest damage, will be back online by Friday, September 22nd. In Cuba, over 70% of the island's power has been restored, and most hospitals and health clinics are functioning normally. But in Haiti, which missed the eye of Hurricane Irma, Telesur reports that heavy rains and winds have swept away fields with rice and plantains along coastal areas, leaving thousands of Haitian farmers in dire straits. The agricultural ministry in Haiti has assessed that the subsistence food crops of roughly 18,000 family farms were destroyed during the storm. Turning to international news and the Rohingya who are fleeing Myanmar. The Rohingya Muslim minority is being forced to flee their homeland by government troops and Buddhist mobs who burn their homes, but then they cast the blame on the Rohingyas. This week, the UN top human rights official slammed Myanmar for conducting a cruel military operation against Rohingya Muslims in Rakhine State, branding it a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Zaid Raad Al Hussein said, "We've received multiple reports and satellite imagery of security forces and local militia burning Rohingya villages and consistent accounts of extrajudicial killings, including shooting fleeing civilians." The leader of Myanmar, which used to be called Burma, is Aung San Suu Kyi. She is facing outrage over the violence, which has forced 400,000 Rohingya Muslims to flee to Bangladesh, which is totally overwhelmed by the influx of refugees. The situation is desperate there in the refugee camps. There are shortages of everything, food, shelter, and clean water, and Rohingya children are at high risk of contracting waterborne diseases. In terms of volume and speed, the flow of Rohingya refugees into Bangladesh is unprecedented, according to Chris Lam. He's the Asia-Pacific spokesperson with IOM, the International Organization for Migration.
It's an enormous challenge, not simply because of the numbers. About 370,000 people have come across in the last 2.5 weeks. But it's the speed of their arrival and the fact that they were, for the most part, unexpected. So any contingency planning in place in Cox's Bazar, this relatively small area into which they've come, is clearly insufficient. I think UN agencies and also the government were expecting, you know, the possibility that as many as 100,000 more people could come across when there were already 600,000 Rohingyas in Bangladesh. But I don't think anybody expected, you know, a mass outflow like this. This is a large population of very, very vulnerable, traumatized people. I just came back from one of the biggest, what they call makeshift settlements. And you see really hundreds of people in a pretty desperate state who are camped out virtually anywhere they can find space. So that's on the side of the road, any spare sort of muddy piece of land, and on hillsides in forests and so on. And these are very desperate people. And a lot of private citizens, I think, are stepping up aid. But of course, these people need much more. They need proper camps. They need a coordinated emergency response that is fully funded by the international community. You know, the pictures that people are seeing on their television screens and on social media should be a very good reason for the international community to step up and help these people.
Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres reiterated the need to end the wave of violence in Myanmar. Ahead of the General Assembly high-level debate, which starts next Tuesday, Guterres highlighted the severity of the humanitarian situation. Ana Carmo reports.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres reiterated his call for Muslims from Myanmar's Rakhine State to be granted nationality or at least a legal status that would allow them to lead a normal life. He also urged the international community to help provide assistance for the nearly 380,000 people who have fled into Bangladesh. He spoke to the press ahead of the General Assembly high-level debate that starts next Tuesday.
I call on the Myanmar authorities to suspend military action, end the violence, uphold the rule of law, and recognize the right of return of all those who had to leave the country.
Mr. Guterres repeated his call for an effective action plan to address the root causes of the crisis. The Security Council was due to discuss the situation on Wednesday afternoon in an urgent closed-door meeting following an official letter from the Secretary General expressing his concern. Here is Mr. Guterres again.
The humanitarian situation is catastrophic. When we met last week, there were 125,000 Rohingya refugees who had fled into Bangladesh. That number has now tripled to nearly 380,000. Many are staying in makeshift settlements or with host communities who are generally sharing what they have. But women and children are arriving hungry and malnourished.
The humanitarian community has launched this week a $77 million appeal to aid some of the stateless refugees for the next 3 months. Ana Carmo, United Nations.
Meanwhile, the UN Security Council met behind closed doors. They called for immediate steps to end the violence in Myanmar's Rakhine State. Following the meeting, Ethiopian Ambassador Takeda Alumo said this.
The members of the Security Council expressed deep concern about the situation in the Rakhine State, acknowledging the initial attack on Myanmar security forces on 25th August. They condemned the subsequent violence, which has led to over 370,000 people being displaced.
Alumo, whose country is currently presiding over the Security Council, it shifts each month. He said members agreed on the importance of finding a long-term solution to the situation in Rakhine State and called for the implementation of the recommendation of the Advisory Commission. It was headed by former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
They noted the commitments made by the government of Myanmar to provide humanitarian assistance to all displaced individuals without discrimination. They called on the government of Myanmar to fulfill these commitments, facilitate humanitarian assistance to those in need in Rakhine State, and to ensure the protection and safety of humanitarian actors.
Aung San Suu Kyi's office said she won't attend the upcoming UN General Assembly because of the crisis. The exodus of refugees is the biggest problem she has faced since becoming Myanmar's leader last year. Meanwhile, critics have called for her to be stripped of her Nobel Peace Prize for failing to do more to end the killings. In her first address last year to the UN General Assembly as national leader, she defended her government's efforts to resolve the crisis over treatment of the Muslim minority. And you're listening to the news over listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. This week saw condolences pouring in for Edie Windsor, the LGBT activist who died in Manhattan at the age of 88. Danny Drum, Queens Council member, was a close friend.
Some of my earliest memories of Edie Windsor and Thea Speier date back to maybe 15 or 20 years ago when I first met them at a St. Pat's for All event. Edie and Thea really loved St. Pat's for All, and they attended almost every single event we held. They were very friendly with Brendan Fay and with Jesus LeBron, and Jesus was also involved with St. Pat's for All. I remember when Thea was in the wheelchair and she would come to the shows at the Irish Arts Center, which served as fundraisers for St. Pat's for All. And I remember seeing how much in love they were with each other and how much attention Edie paid to Thea and her needs and took care of her. And I remember Brendan Fay telling me that Edie wanted to marry Thea and that they didn't know what to do or how to go about it. And so I think it was in about 2007 when Brendan Fay and Jesus LeBron had already founded the Civil Marriage Trail, and they suggested to Edie that she go to Canada to get married, and they helped make the arrangements for Edie and Thea to go. And I think Brendan actually went with them up to Canada, and the judge that married them was the same judge that married Brendan and Tom Moulton. And so that's how Edie was able to get married. And then I remember when Edie wanted to sue the government after Thea had died, and she felt it was so wrong that the government was trying to take a huge amount of tax money, over $350,000, that would have been her money if Thea's name had just been Theo, as she would say. She reached out to Brendan again, and Brendan referred her over to my friends Vinny Maniscalco and Eddie DeBonis, and they were the ones who connected Edie with Robbie Kaplan, because Lambda wouldn't take the case. Lambda didn't think it was the perfect case to move forward on to defeat the Defense of Marriage Act. But it actually wound up being the perfect case, because ultimately it was Edie and through Robbie's work that the Defense of Marriage Act fell. My other memories of Edie involve being with her at various marches. I remember one march that we attended after the murder of, I think his name was Mark Carson, on the corner of West 8th Street and 6th Avenue. Edie showed up at the center, ready to march in high heels, and she had to be, beyond 80 years old, and those high heels kept getting stuck in the potholes along the way, and she would grab my arm and hold on to me for dear safety as we marched up 6th Avenue, I guess it was, to protest the murder of Mark Carson. But Edie was a great marcher, and one of my best memories of Edie, of course, was when in 2016 we won the right to march in the 5th Avenue St. Patrick's Day Parade, and Edie was there in the front line holding the banner, and just prior to stepping off, Brendan Fay, Tom Moulton, Edie, Judith, myself, and Malachi McCourt stood and we sang Go Lassie Go as we were waiting to step off onto 5th Avenue. So I have lots of Edie memories that really bring back such a good feeling about what Edie represented and what she did for the LGBT communities. And Edie was involved in many groups right through the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and up until the day she died. Edie was always there for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community.
New York City Council member from Queens, Danny Drum. And here's Edie Windsor outside the Supreme Court after the U.S. v. Windsor oral argument, which challenged DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, on March 27, 2013.
Hi, I'm Edie Windsor, and somebody wrote me a large speech, which I'm not going to make, but there are a couple of things I wanted to say. One, I wanted to tell you what marriage meant to me. It's kind of crazy. We lived together for 40 years. We were engaged with the circle diamond pin because I wouldn't wear a ring because I was still in the closet. Okay. I am today an out lesbian, okay, who just sued the United States of America, which is kind of overwhelming for me. When my beautiful, sparkling Thea died 4 years ago, I was overcome with grief. Within a month, I was hospitalized with a heart attack. And that's kind of common. It's usually looked at as broken heart syndrome. In the midst of my grief, I realized that the federal government was treating us as strangers, and I paid a humongous estate tax. And it meant selling a lot of stuff to do it, and it wasn't easy. I live on a fixed income, and it wasn't easy. Many people ask me, why get married? I was 77, Thea was 75, okay? And maybe we were older than that at that point. But the fact is that everybody treated it as different. It turns out marriage is different, okay? And I've asked a number of long-range couples, gay couples, who then got married. I've asked them, you know, was it different the next morning? And the answer is always yes. It's a huge difference. When our marriage appeared in the New York Times, we heard from literally hundreds of people. I mean, little playmates and schoolmates and colleagues and friends and relatives all congratulating us and sending love because we were married. So it's a magic word. For anybody who doesn't understand why we want it and why we need it, okay, it is magic. The only other thing I want to say is we did win in the lower courts. This today is like a spectacular event for me. It's a lifetime kind of event. And I know that the spirit of my late spouse, the Aspire, okay, is right here watching and listening and would be very proud and happy of where we've come to. Thank you all.
LGBT activist Edie Windsor, who died in Manhattan this week at the age of 88, and her legacy lives on. This week, a new exhibit opened which looks at LGBT discrimination through the lens of modern history. The inspiration for the exhibit at the Church of the Village in Manhattan was the passage of the Marriage Equality Act. Matt Patterson visited the exhibit and he sends us this report.
It takes a moment to adjust to how dark it is inside the space. Deep maroon carpeting covers the floor, and a maroon and rose floral fabric lines the walls. Several clusters of paintings are on display. There are a half dozen simple line drawings of faces, as well as a series that appears to be the Stations of the Cross in white, blue, and gold. 30 chairs face a wooden statue at the front of the space. It's a man with a youthful face, flowing locks of hair, and hands clasped as he strides forward. That man is Oscar Wilde, the 19th century Irish writer who was persecuted for being a gay man in Victorian England.
We wanted to do this project 25 years ago, but we never finished it.
That's Peter McGough, one half of the design duo McDermott and McGough, the creators of the Oscar Wilde Temple. The temple, which opened to the public this week, has taken over a small chapel below the main hall of the Church of the Village. Oscar Wilde was a renowned novelist, poet, and playwright. He lived from 1864 to 1900. He refused to hide his sexuality, even when faced with imprisonment and hard labor. This is what attracted McGough and his partner to Wilde. They originally sought to create the temple in Wilde's native home of Ireland.
And so this castle in Ireland offered us a show in their chapel. And it was, I was going to do a photography show because one collector has a lot of our photographs. And then when I saw that they passed the Marriage Act in Ireland, they passed the Marriage Act here in the States. And then I watched from my window Cuomo marry a same-sex couple in front of the landmarked Stonewall Inn. I thought, well, we can't do a photography show. We got to do the Oscar Wilde Temple.
But before that installation could be realized, it was canceled. McGough says locals felt it made fun of the Catholic Church. But now, with the help of the LGBT Community Center, it has a new home in Manhattan. McGough says the temple pays tribute to Wilde while it ties his struggles to the modern LGBT movement. The Stations of the Cross are reinterpreted to portray Oscar Wilde's trial and imprisonment for sodomy and gross indecency. And there are 6 portraits which pay tribute to more recent victims of violence, including Shulhaj Manan, a Bangladeshi man who was brutally murdered last year for operating the only LGBT magazine in Bangladesh, and Marsha P. Johnson, a trans activist in New York. McGough knew Johnson from the neighborhood, but he was devastated as he researched LGBT victims of violence from around the world for this exhibit.
To murder them for who they were was so crushing, especially the trans women, was really upsetting to me, because I have trans friends, and it was horrifying. The list just never seemed to stop. So I just thought, these people need to be honored. And there's only 6 now, you know. I mean, I could cover this place.
While the temple pays tribute to victims of discrimination, McGough says the installation is meant to be a space for celebration.
I've felt that this is a wonderful place for people to get married in, because there's no demonizing eyes of a dogma denouncing them. This is a place where they can feel safe.
In addition to hosting private events, the installation will be home to talks and poetry readings throughout the fall.
Everything for this temple is a fundraiser. And, you know, people can get married. They can have a ceremony here. They can have a memorial here. And the fee that they pay goes to LGBT homeless youth at risk. Those are like the kids of Oscar Wilde.
The temple is located at the Church of the Village, 201 West 13th Street at 7th Avenue, across the street from the LGBT Center in Manhattan. It's open to the public from Tuesday to Saturday, noon to 7, each week through December 2nd, 2017. Matt Patterson, WBAI News, New York.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, September 14th, 2017. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.